of reinforcement learning stuff is using that. So this is, did anyone look at the note, look at the actual, some of the references where you could do it? Okay. So this is, I don't know exactly, I wanted to, I've introduced this mainly because I wanted to get a different look at material from the design point of view. And the various design systems at the bottom, where they look at things. It's still essentially the same kind of things you've seen before, finding out from the past, but they sort of grew it into a different way. So I want to finish that up today. Learning is a very important technology, and reinforcement learning is crucial to robotics, applications like robotics, where you have a system interactive environment. The idea is to try to simulate what we think happens with human learning, where a child does math again, and the parent provides some kind of corrective feedback, questions, or wrong, or even what's fine. So that's sort of the principle involved here. And this kind of thing that we use in many areas. So the form that we're talking about today comes largely from the Goddard. So I think as soon as I went through everything, I'm going to talk about the structure. So we created this agent environment concept, and we're going to talk about things like actions and rewards and that kind of stuff that we've got. Rewards are going to be identified are, and then we've got these action A and state F. So it sort of looks like it's essentially a mock-up process for kind of 15 that gets described in the system. So then I think we went through this process of implementing the policy and the whole concept of trying to maximize the reward. And one thing that sort of differentiates these applications, complex applications like robotics, is oftentimes there's not a single objective function that you're maximizing, but you've got a lot of these agents operating simultaneously. Then you've got some process that just overall tries to manage the overall return. So that strategy is becoming more and more common in systems that consist of a collection of subsystems, where each of the subsystems is doing the more classic optimization of the objective function. But oftentimes it's difficult then to have a system that merges all those outputs through a global optimization because you don't have feedback paths and you just want to use the subsystems. So one of the things that several years ago we were building systems like speech understanding systems where you actually had a bunch of distributed agents to the model. The system that you had could actually consist of a number of servers that could actually be geographically distributed. So we were doing these kinds of demos where you had servers all over the country, exclusive sites. And then your system was connecting to these. Each one of these servers would do various tasks. Like one would do natural language processing, one would do recognition. And so the reason the problem is formulated this way in such a context, I can't really talk directly to that remote server and get into the internals that all I'm really allowed to do is the passive input of the output. But I would like my overall system to be able to merge the outputs of all these systems in some sort of optimal way. That's kind of the language of the environment that makes a lot of talked about returns, and one of the two concepts is we talked about discounting, this concept of having some kind of weighting on your associated with returns with your individual rewards. So as an example, I think Sundar talked about this problem of hill climbing, and the goal is to get to the top of the hill as quickly as possible. One way to achieve that would be to set up a reward function where you reward minus one for the step taken when you're not at the top of the hill, and then the return is essentially minus the number of total steps, and the return is maximized by minimizing the number of steps to the top of the hill. So you could pose this, you could use this kind of agent action environment to solve this problem if you set it, if you set up the objective function properly, and then you can produce a solution. Of course, there's many different ways you can set up the problem, and there's many different solutions to the result. So if this were, for example, in this kind of a problem, if your goal was to minimize your gas consumption versus getting to the hill, top of the hill as soon as possible, if the goal was to minimize your gas consumption, you'd actually find a different solution to the problem. Because minimize gas consumption is probably not the best way to do that. If you're adjusting your speed appropriately, that kind of thing. One of the important things in robotics, or in any kind of an application where you're dealing with a dynamic system, is you have to be prepared for the fact that the task can change or the context can change at some point in time. So in an airline reservation system, if you find somebody the best reservation, that's obviously going to depend on the availability of certain flights and things like that. But that status is going to change in a continuous way. So the system has to be prepared to react to the environment. The same thing with robotics. If you're trying to basically get a robot from point A to point B, well, you could solve that problem in a two-forward way where you simply plot that course. But what happens if an object doesn't appear? So one of the things that makes these systems really special and really important, it's a really important problem, is that they have to be able to adapt to change in the environment and then recalculate the optimization function so that they can adjust to that but still find an optimal solution. And that's one of the things that makes any of these kinds of interactive environments really challenging. So another example of that comes from game theory, that when you talk about playing games like chess with a computer, a large part of what the game has to recalculate optimal functions at every step, which is responding to the way your opponent plays. So you calculate a move, and that's what you do with global optimization. Then your opponent makes a move, and now you have to react to that. So each step along the way, you're trying to do the optimal thing. But then when you look back after the game has been concluded, and you look at how your opponent behaves, how you behave, very often you'll find, well, I could have played a much better game. The computer could have made better choices if I had known what each step, what the opponent was going to do. So if you then go back and analyze that game, with now knowing what steps the opponent is going to take, knowing what steps you take, because very often you can find a different set of steps you can take in the decision that you're moving. So the global or optimal solution to that problem could be one thing. But that's not really relevant because you're making the reaction to the opponent in real time to be solved. You're trying to take the optimal path, you're trying to make an optimal choice at every step along the way. That may not be the globally optimal set of actions, but that's sort of all you can do because you're responding to a time to the time. So what games like that try to do is they try to look ahead and they try to guess what are the most likely things the opponent's going to do, and then you're assuming that you start to put the cost of their effect. And that's why the problems become computationally very difficult. There's so many different ways your opponent can react, and so many ways you can react to those reactions, so you're getting this exponential growth basically. So this is the general model that we're going to do, but what sort of differentiates this from, I would say, the hidden Markov model type problems that we've looked at before, is that the parameters of this model can change at each point in time, the dynamics of this model. So we're more interested in how do we react at any given point in time than finding the overall global solution. So one of the ways that we can do this is using a technology called Markov Decision Processes. And this is, again, it's very similar to what you've already seen with the Markov model, but concept's been developed in the context of this kind of real-time decision. So the state at step two refers to whatever information is available for the agent at step two about the environment. State can include immediate sensation, highly processed sensation, constructive buildup over time, consistent sensation. That's kind of robotic jargon. It's simply saying that we're going to have some ability to model the state of the system at each step of time, and the state is going to be the embody that reflection of that knowledge. Ideally, a state could summarize past sensations so as to retain all essential information. It could have the Markov property, which means that the probability of taking a step at time 2 plus 1 and obtaining a reward at time 2 plus 1 is simply going to be conditioned on where you were at time 2 minus 1, 2 minus 2, and so on, all the way back to 0. This is what we call the history. Now, what makes this calculation so difficult is that if these histories are exponentially growing amount of memory, so if you have two states, let's say, if it's just a first-order Markov process, then when you're considering time 2 plus 1, all you have to do is think about, all you have to do is essentially look at those two states, the previous history. So now if you have a second-order process where you're not just looking at the current state but the previous state, you've got two states, those in turn could have been affected by two previous states. So you have two times two or four possible histories that you have to consider. And if you have two more, you have to go back to the third-order process, it's two times two times two. So it's an exponentially growing search state. And that's what makes the problem very difficult. Now, in some problems, if the cost functions are not constructed properly, you're going to have to do that kind of backward look. And doing that, we do this, for example, speech recognition. Then you begin to look at suboptimal search strategies where you try to prune the number of active histories. So you only have to search through a reasonable set of those histories. And you prune them based on things like language, which is what we call beam searching. The problem with that, of course, is that a history can look very bad at one point in time, but then a few steps later, it's become one of the better histories to look at. So it's suboptimal. When you try to limit the number of histories that you look at, and you try to truncate these, you can risk taking a suboptimal decision. But on the other hand, you have to do that because the search space is so large, the problem becomes intractable unless you do some kind of limiting in the search space. So what we'll do in speech recognition when we're operating on word sequences, for example, is we will use what's called an n-gram model, where we look at the current word as a function of the two previous words. That's what's called the trigram model. And in speech recognition, we can decode bigram, two word sequences in real time. We can do trigram sequences in real time, they're a little bit more expensive. But we can't do 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 word sequences. That's just too much. That would take gigabytes and terabytes of memory. So that's why we often create suboptimal systems where we do a first pass using a bigram to try to get the promising pass, and then we'll restore those paths using a trigram, using a more sophisticated model like a trigram or a quadram. And then eventually, when we get down to a maybe 10 or 100 as the most promising possibility, we'll go back and restore those with an 11th order model, very complicated model. But we're only scoring them in a small number of possibilities. So if you've ever watched, for example, Castanets, you notice that it spits out the text, but then when you put a sentence boundary up, and it'll go back and it'll rewrite what it's out to and change some of the words. That's an indication of a multi-path search phrase. But when it spits out initially with the bigram or trigram result, but then when it goes back and corrects it, that's the process that we explore in the multi-path. And you sometimes will see a similar type of thing in Microsoft Word, for example. You type in an on, and then it's just a sentence boundary, and it goes back and highlights the specific result. It can choose to highlight the specific result. But so what we're most interested in this context is what's called reinforcement learning. And this has a Markovian property, which is basically a Markov decision property. The state and action sets are finite. It's what we call a finite Markov decision process, which consists of usual parameters for Markov models. Now, not all systems are this way, but we can build the system to obey this property by constraining it such that the action at time t plus 1 are conditioned only on the action at time 2. And that would be what we call the first order Markov decision process. In this case, the transition probability then is given by a simple transition from the current state to the state of t plus 1 conditioned on being at state 2 and conditioned on taking the action at time 2. And then we have a slightly modified expression for the output probability of the state. And in the context of this reinforcement learning, we talk about reward as being the expectation of the reward at time t plus 1, given that we're in state time t plus 1. S at time 2, you took an action at time 2, that would be transitioning to state 2 plus 1 at time 5. So, an example that was used in the context was the concept of a recycling robot. This is a robot that's going to essentially search over some area and pick up cans. This is sort of a variant of the traveling salesman problem. If you've got a lot of cans arranged in an area and you have a robot and your goal is for the robot to pick up as many of these cans as possible, what are some of the ways you might formulate this in a sort of competition setting? Well, one thing you might be concerned about is minimizing the amount of energy the robot has to use. A simple solution would be, of course, to have a starting point and then to just go and pick up each can, return to your starting point, go and pick up each can, return to your starting point. That would be a really inefficient way to do that. On the other hand, if you want to go from point to point, you want to go to one can, pick it up, go to a second can, pick it up, now you have to think about the order in which you do that. It's going to depend. The total energy you use in doing this is going to depend on how and what sequence you pick up each can. And that then becomes a problem of trying to figure out the proper order of pushing things up so that you take as little time as possible and expend as little energy as possible. So there's a couple different actions that can be taken. In this particular scenario, they also actually have a state where the robot can go back to a home base and recharge itself. This is not, this is actually pretty common in these autonomous vehicle type problems. And another different kind of application we face with close to the use of these unmanned flying vehicles, drones, and things like that. And this is a very real issue with the drone. Drones are usually trying to surveil an area with the drone, but you've only got a fixed amount of flight time, so you have to do this kind of calculation of how much you can do before that investment. So they are actually looking at drones with the charge and solar energy, solar power, and things like that. So that makes the problem a little more interesting because when you go back to recharge is something that's going to be a dynamic state because it depends on what the drone is doing and what the concept of the system is. If I can follow that, because too far away from the base station, wouldn't have enough energy to get back to the base station and recharge that problem. So you have to manage all these things in real time, and there's no, and because of that, there's no definitive way to do this. There's a lot of art in arranging the logic so that these vehicles can operate in the environment and not either run out of energy or not do something really efficient. So decisions have to be made based on current energy levels, and we would like to optimize where we live. So here's a simple model along the lines of what we're talking about. It. Markov decision process model for this recycling robot. You have a state which reflects energy, the energy state being high and low. You have a action. When the energy is high, you can take two actions, you can surge and you can wait. But when the energy is low, you have an additional action that you have to take, surge, wait, and discharge. So, this is an example of a model where the action varies from state to state. Remember when we talked about the three-time hidden markup model, we assumed all outputs were possible at all states. Here's an example of a situation where the number of outputs possible is the number of actions at each state. And then you have some rewards. You have the expected number of scans while searching and the expected number of scans while waiting. And you hope that the reward for searching is greater than the reward for waiting. So you can build a Markov decision process that describes this kind of situation, and that would look something like this kind of a network. The value function, the value of a state, is the expected return starting from that state, and it depends on the agent's policy. So there's what we'll call a state value function, the policy is pi. And we'll denote that as capital V, which is pi of f, where f is the state. And that's going to be the expectation of the reward, capital R sub t, given that you're in state x sub t at time f. That is, given that you're in state f times t. And that expectation is going to be essentially the accumulation of all of your rewards starting from k is equal to 0 to infinity, and that's going to be the sum of the gamma, the rating factor, the state power times r to t from k plus 1. All conditioned on the fact that at time f times t, we're in state f. The value of taking an action in a state under policy t is the expected return starting from that state, taking that action and thereafter following the overall policy pi. So the action value function for policy pi we're going to write as q superscript pi. And this is now a function of f and a function of a. It's a function of the state and the action. And this is the expectation of the reward given that you're in state f at time t jointly with the fact that you've taken action A at time B. This can be written as the expectation of the accumulated reward given that you're in state at the time B and that you took action A at time B. So the reason we're writing it this way again reflects the dynamic nature of the problem, that the actions that you might want to take and the value of the various states is going to change as a function of time. You don't know that it's very similar to the hidden Markov model that we talked about previously, except that the parameters of those of them, think of the situation where the parameters of those models are changing as a function of time. So now you can't really do a priori optimization of this network. There's not any one single best path through this network because the parameters of the model are changing as a function of time. Now that creates, from an optimization point of view, that creates a problem because you're going to take an action now which is going to have ramifications in the future. Every action at any point in time affects everything along that optimal path. We'll talk about this in a moment, but you can't really afford to look ahead and look at all possible alternatives in the future. And it's just that so you have to think about ways you can deal with that in a particular way. So Richard Bellman, we talked about Richard Bellman when we talked about dynamic programming. The principle of dynamic programming is also applicable to this kind of situation, and actually Bellman equation can be applied to the formation of policies, optimization policies. So the basic idea is that the total reward at time t is going to be a function of these rewards into the future, as well as what you've accumulated in the past. So, if we constrain the reward function in this way, we want to introduce this weighting function gamma. Now, if we're going to define a reward at time t as a function of things that are going to happen in the future, why do we want to introduce that term gamma, where gamma is between 0 and 1? Exactly. So what is that? If it were a test game, what would that allow us to do if gamma was, let's say, 0.1 or some small number? If you raise gamma, the power gets smaller and smaller. That effectively limits the number of steps we have to consider in the future. So reward, thus far we've been thinking about cost, accumulated cost from time zero to the current time. But in these kinds of environments, you also need to think about what's going to happen in the future because the state of the system is dynamic. It's a subtle, but it's an interesting contrast because in this kind of a robotics application, line about the past is the past, or forget about it, something like that. But, you know, if you're sitting here at this point in time, you don't really care what's happened in the past because you can't change that. But what you do care about is what action you're going to take next is going to have ramifications in the future, and your goal is to optimize the reward so many steps down the line or when you reach the end of this problem. So you want to make an action, you want to take a step now, given everything you know, that will maximize the reward in the future. Well, obviously that's the problem because you don't know what's going to happen in the future. But you can at least make a guess by creating a reward function, something like this. And by structuring it this way and setting gamma to be left between 0 and 1, we can actually write a nice little recursion that the reward at time t is going to be the reward at time t plus 1 plus the incremental reward plus this function at time t plus 1. So what we're essentially able to do is to write a recursion which expresses the reward at the current time as a function of the action we're going to take now plus the total accumulated action in the future. This is sort of a it's looking in the future, but it's just a reverse of what we talked about with dynamic programming, where the total cost for the next step was some incremental cost plus everything previously. So this allows us to apply notions of the principle of optimality because there's a nice iterative relationship which says that I need to only, if I take an optimal step here, I'll sort of be guaranteed that the overall optimal path was instrumentally an optimal step. So then we can write that B superscript pi of s is just the expectation of this function, and that in turn can be written in this recursive manner using B of s at t plus 1, given that we were in space x at time 2. And we can replace the expectation operator with just a sum over all possible states. So this allows us essentially to write a finite state machine that describes if we're sitting at state S at time T, we can then think about all possible actions as being passed along this tree. It's a tree that's looking forward in time, but it's still nevertheless just a finite state machine or a tree or graph. And therefore, then if we don't have to look too far ahead, the process of making an optimal decision at time t becomes simply a search of all possible actions into the future. And again, that's essentially what testing is doing. They sit at a current point in time, they try to look ahead so many moves, and calculate the cost of all those moves in the future. The problem is when they make that move, then your opponent makes another move to that person, that calculates all over them at the next point in time. So that's why chess games often cost, one of the figures of merit of chess machines is how far into the future they are. A lot of work has been done on trying to look into the future in an intelligent way, so you're not simply doing an exhaustive search of all possible paths. So optimal value functions. For finite Markov decision processing, policies can be partially ordered. So we can write that one policy is better than another if and only if the function B is greater than B for the corresponding alternate policy. There's always at least one and possibly many policies that are better than or equal to all the others. And that's what we call an optimal policy. And we note that optimal policies share the same optimal state value function. It's just now we're going to try to find the maximum over all of these state value functions. Optimal policies also share the same optimal action value function. So again, we can maximize this. We can find a maximum action value function by simply searching for a maximum overall previous policies. Now the reason, and this is the expected return for taking action A and state S, and thereafter following optimal policy. So the thing here is that we can do this maximization can be done incrementally because of the constraint that we can write the current reward in terms of our next action plus all future rewards. So being able to do this efficiently hinges on being able to apply the same principles that we've applied to the program. So the value of a state under an optimal policy must equal the expected return for the best action of that state. So the value of a state is going to be a maximum of this true function over all possible actions A. And we can write that as the maximum of the expectation of R of T plus 1 plus gamma times the same function that we optimize at T plus 1, given that we're at state at time T and we took action at time T. So this starts to look like what you've seen for dynamic programming, only it's looking forward into time and space. And we can write this in terms of policy because we have this the expectation of essentially just summation. So the process of finding this maximum is going to be require essentially looking at all possible ways that we can take this action at time T, all possible ways into the future that could hinge on or related to that action. So this B star then becomes a unique solution, and that can be, in the general case, a nonlinear, require a nonlinear optimization. But we won't worry about that for the moment. So the optimal action is again found through the maximization process and involves then simply sort of maximizing this function. And two stars in this solution. So what we're really doing here is laying out in a general sense the process of finding the overall best set of actions, and that's done using essentially the same kinds of calculations that we use for dynamic programming, but that operate by looking into the future rather than into the past. So finding an optimal policy by solving the Bellman equation, optimality equation, requires the following. It requires accurate knowledge of the environment dynamics. It requires that we have enough space and time to do the computation, and it requires restricting the problem to the Markovian property. Now, how much space and time do we need? Well, the computational complexity of this is polynomial in the number of states. We can use dynamic programming methods, but we have to constrain the value functions so that they only require one or two look-ahead. And in these kinds of robotics applications, the value functions can be a little more complicated than what we've seen in, for example, traditional with Markov processes. So, if you remember, in Markov processes, when we posed the dynamic programming problem, when we wanted to compute the cost of a state, all we had to do was look back at the previous state. Remember, we drew this out of the trellis. And we said, well, to compute the cost here, we just need to look at all the previous states that could have transitioned to that state and find the best one. But that was because the cost function of the distance metric that we used was only a function of the difference between the current state and the previous state. In these kinds of robotics problems, you often can't do that. The cost function may actually be a function of the current state and the previous state. So you may have a cost function where you have to look over not just the previous column, but the two previous columns. So you get this kind of polynomial explosion. And then on top of that, the number of states is often huge. For example, apparently if you're playing backgammon, you know much about backgammon, but relatively simple board game, you would think the number of states, if you try to apply these kinds of equations The number of possible states in that game is 10. California. So, and I think chess, you know, chess had similar effects. That's how we think it's more complicated than that. So, the problem with these kinds of approaches is that the number of alternatives that we have to look into in the future can be very large and can grow exponentially. So, we usually have to settle for approximations. Many reinforcement learning methods can be understood as approximately solving the dominant optionality equation. So, that's simply a way of stating that because the search space is so large, you have to apply suboptimal search techniques. And one of the ways that we will typically do that, see, this is a little bit different than what we've done with Markov models, because with Markov models, you're evaluating, you're building the overall cost as a function of time. So when I'm at time t, I know what the costs were for the previous state. If you think about the state of the network, you started at time zero, and for example, in that case, we have the initial probabilities of each state. You go to time one, and you increment those by one. You go to time two, and so forth. So you have all that information. So when I want to take an action at time two, I know everything for all of previous time. I've already done those computations. Now, what's different about this kind of agent type environment, for example, trying to make a robot make a series of optimal moves, in these kinds of problems, we're more interested in what's happening in the future. So, because the state of the game is changing at every point in time. It doesn't matter that you can't build on top of all these calculations you've done previously, because the state of the game is changing. So you're much more interested in what is going to happen in the future. Well, that causes a problem computationally, because that's equivalent to doing this dynamic programming calculation at every point in time for all possible future states. That's an exponentially growing question. So you can't do that. So what are the kinds of things you can do? Well, that's where, for example, that gamma function comes important, because that's the weight. That's weight constraint. Because one of the things we can certainly do is we can consider only the most promising actions that are possible from here forward. And so you can essentially prune the network and only look at the set of paths that are most promising. So you say, well, maybe I'll look at the top three paths that are most promising. Well, now again, the problem here is that it's not simply enough to look at to look one ahead. If you're playing chess, for example, you have to look many states ahead. So even though there's three paths that you can look, you're going to reduce your look to those three paths. You now have to consider, let's say you want to look 10 moves ahead. You have those three, and then transition into how many other states. Your second move ahead, your third move ahead. You know, so this thing still grows exponentially. And you have to do that calculation at every point in time. It's not like you can build that calculation up to first degree in time like you do when you're looking backwards. So that's why, you know, a lot of attention is paid to this calculation of these policies and optimal actions at each point in time. But ultimately, all you're really doing is you're evaluating a limited number of paths through this network, and you're doing that at each point in time. That's what you're looking at. So it's still accumulating calculations across the finite state machine, but it's just, it's got to be done every state. we don't get that computational advantage that we got with the next program, but the calculations are linear, roughly linear for time with the next dimension. So, and that's what makes these kinds of problems so difficult. Now, if you think about a robotics application, what makes it even more interesting, if you've ever studied any of the work where people figure out, for example, how to move the robot from point A to point B. But another thing that makes it difficult is there's many different ways you can do that. If you think about when you move your arm, when I go to grab an object, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about how I'm going to grab that object. There's many different ways I could do that. I could do this. And so there's all these degrees of freedom, and that's also a search space that has to be dealt with. It's not just the action of I want to pick up that object, but it's how you actually get there. And there's so many degrees of freedom in this robot. If you think about from here trying to pick up that object, I have to decide whether I'm going to take a step, whether I'm going to loop, I'm going to lean, all these kinds of things. So these search spaces are very, very large for these things. Now, another topic that I'll just briefly mention is something called true learning. And I mention this just because it's a term you see in the literature, which in recent years has been one of the hot learning topics. So true learning, and it's a special type of reinforcement learning that works by learning an action value function. It's making a given action in a given space following the policy thereafter. The strength of true learning is that it's able to compare the expected utility of the available action without requiring a model of the environment. The value Q of SNA, which is our function that we've been talking about in terms of space and action, is defined to be the expected discounted sum of future payoffs obtained by taking action A from state S and following an optimal policy thereafter. Once these values have been learned, the optimal action from any state is the one with the highest Q value. The core of the algorithm is a simple value iteration update for each state S and each state set capital S and for each action A and the action set A, capital A. We can calculate an update to its expected discount reward with the following expression that we can essentially update our Q function based on some weight of the action and state that we're in at time t plus trying to maximize the change in the Q function from t plus 1 to t. So it's a way of incrementally, it's essentially trying to take the next action will essentially be the one that sort of maximizes the difference in the Q function, the incremental difference in the Q function. This can be thought of as incrementally maximizing the next step, one look ahead. It may not be the globally optimal solution, but it's an approach that's being used in a lot of reinforcement learning applications. So this is essentially, you can think of this in a general sense as a one look ahead type algorithm that you pose your update equation. So I just mentioned this because in the learning literature you see people talking about true learning. It's not that much different from things you've already seen, but it is kind of basically so what we tried to do in this lecture is to really give an alternate view of process of optimizing your path through a network, but to state that in a framework that's amenable to projects with applications where you're dealing with dynamic environments like processing about the project. So I know this has been abstract and you haven't worked with actual problems with this stuff yet, but I just wanted to include this because this is some, the whole learning literature is becoming a very an important area to understand within that literature that people present. Half the battle with a lot of this stuff is that these different communities use different notations, different does. A lot of times, the hardest part is just understanding where they're trying to solve. And once you understand that, then you say, oh, well, that's not going to be difficult. So I just try to present it in the language that you will see in the language. Okay. We'll see you on Monday.